But
for those that follow dogs chasing birds in wild places, you have come to the right place to have your knowledge fueled.
Lily, hunt him up.
I'm your host, Dr. Joe Spoo, the Gun Dog Doc. Join us as we expand your knowledge on dog health, training, and just about every topic under the sun as it relates to bettering your life with the dog. We will bring you experts from around the world, along with my own experiences as a veterinary specialist focused on the sporting breeds. Fueled is presented by Yukonuba Dog Food. Out in the field, how you prepare determines how you perform. With optimally balanced fat and protein to support peak condition, Yukonuba Premium Performance helps enhance strength, energy, and endurance. So when the pavement ends and the truck door finally swings open, you and your dogs are ready for anything. Sporting dogs give you everything they've got. Their nutrition should do the same. Make your dog a Yukonuba dog. In this episode of Fueled, we talk with my good friend, Dr. Rick Wall. Dr. Wall is a sports medicine and rehabilitation specialist who owns practices in the Woodlands area of Houston, Texas. He is the immediate past president of the Texas VMA and an innovator in the area of myofascial pain and pain relief in our canine patients. Dr. Wall and his lab, Caleb, duck hunt the famed Katy Prairie of Texas, as well as the Texas Gulf Coast. In this episode, we take a deep dive into compensatory muscle pain in the canine patient. So often we think of these dogs as bones and joints, and while bone and joint injuries are important, they can lead to many compensatory muscle issues. Muscle pain and dysfunction are very under-recognized issues with our canine athletes, and one that too often goes undiagnosed and untreated. We talk about identifying the issues and treatment options. If you have a dog that is having difficulty recovering from a surgery, looking to optimize performance after surgery, or have a dog with aches and pains and drugs just don't seem to cut it, this episode is for you. Dr. Wall, thanks for being with us on the show. If you want to maybe introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, Joe, thank you for inviting me. My name is Rick Wall. I'm a veterinarian who practices in the Woodlands, Texas, which is a suburb just north of Houston. I came to this area '79, graduated from the vet school at Texas A&M, and to primarily do equine work, which I ended up doing 100% equine for a number of years. But in 1991, I decided to sell to my partner and actually leave veterinary practice to enter family business for 3 years with no intentions of ever returning. About 3 years into family business, I said, I want to go back to being a veterinarian. And so I did, but I got back into small animal medicine and surgery and really had been away from it for almost 15 years. So I had a big learning curve. That was in 1995 when I opened that. About 15, 16 years ago, I started, even longer than that, I guess now, I started to develop an interest in rehabilitation. And in 2004, I opened my third office in this area, which included a rehab facility, and I became certified in veterinary rehabilitation in 2004. And because of my interest in rehabilitation, I quickly learned I also needed to develop some expertise in pain management. Because I learned very quickly that you could not effectively rehabilitate a dog that was in pain. So I started studying a lot in pain management and took acupuncture courses and all that. And then, of course, along with you, my study partner, we became board certified in sports medicine and rehabilitation in 2015.
And then, so you're my first guest that, you know, has the rehabilitation background. And so let's maybe just talk a little bit about, you know, we use the term rehabilitation in veterinary medicine because physical therapy is a protected term in on the human side, but maybe give us your thoughts on what rehabilitation encompasses in veterinary medicine.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been interested in this as a new field a long, long, long time ago. And there was an original treadmill company called Furno, which is no longer around. And they were holding some seminars on underwater treadmill at a veterinarian named John Sherman, who was in North Carolina. And John was one of the very, very first veterinarians to have any interest in rehabilitation. And he basically developed that interest to try to get his own field trial dogs back to competing. And so I went and spent some time with John and made the decision that I was going to try to get involved in that. And I always had an interest in orthopedics and did quite a bit of orthopedic surgery within my own practice around that time. And I knew that we needed to do something to these patients following orthopedic surgery to help restore their function better, or quicker, I should say. And so physical therapy in people has gained a lot of popularity. And I think many, many orthopedic surgeons on the human healthcare side would almost refuse to do certain surgeries if you were not going to go to physical therapy afterwards, because it just affects the outcomes. But I guess my definition of rehabilitation is actually pretty simple. It's restoration, and it's restoration of normal or as near normal function of that limb or spine or whole body to the pre-injury or pre-illness status. And we help our patients in rehabilitation by employing different modalities such as an underwater treadmill and lasers and manual therapies and needling therapies. And we employ all that in order to restore function quicker than perhaps it would be restored on its own. And along the way, there's patients that we make huge differences in. We actually will see patients, and I think everybody that does canine rehabilitation will say the same thing. You see patients where we make a big difference. And we maybe the difference in an unsuccessful outcome to successful outcome, the dog that injured its hip or had hip surgery and hasn't used the leg in 3 months. Well, there's no reason to think if you don't intervene in that patient, the next month they're going to go start using it. And surgeons' technical skills are tremendous. We have a lot of surgeons. I'm in a suburban urban area. We have a lot of board certified surgeons. And I'm also about an hour's drive from the veterinary school at Texas A&M. But that's not their training. Their training is to do the surgery. And so many times those patients afterwards need a different kind of care to help return them to function at a quicker pace than they might would on their own.
What would you say the acceptance, you know, I the surgeon I work closely with, obviously we do a lot of rehab together here. I would say in this part of the country, it's not, maybe they're not as progressive, or they, you know, going back to, it's not their training. How are the surgeons in your area as far as acceptance of rehab or promoting it with clients? I feel like there's still a segment of that specialty that is resistant. Are you seeing the same thing in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I did years ago, and just basically because it was new and unknown, and we had years ago, we're still lacking on true studies in rehabilitation, but years ago, we didn't even have anecdotal observations from what I consider high quality practitioners. I'm older now than most of the surgeons in the greater Houston area and A&M, and I've got years of, age doesn't mean knowledge, but the older you get, people think you're smarter. So I have a lot of good relationships with surgeons in the greater Houston area that will reach out to me, and as well as neurologists now, but it's taken a long, and they'll reach out to me on difficult cases and they'll refer me cases. And I'm on, in essence, pretty much a first name basis with almost all surgeons and neurologists in the greater Houston area and Texas A&M for that matter. The people that are involved in rehab at Texas A&M, a lot of those people came through my clinic for training. So I think some of the years of being there to answer questions and also them seeing the outcomes of some of their patients that maybe they were having trouble with, it's developed a level of respect. So I don't encounter that like I did maybe years ago.
Okay.
Occasionally you'll run into a situation, maybe with like a young resident or something that hasn't been exposed to rehabilitation, but they can be fun to visit with as well.
Right. So one of the areas that you've kind of become you know, nationally and internationally known for is the myofascial trigger point part of this. And I think it's an area, you know, we talk about in vet school and I would say a vast majority of veterinarians, we're kind of taught that these dogs are bones and joints. And if they're painful, we give them an NSAID, you know, we throw drugs at it. And if that doesn't work, it just, you know, nothing's going to work. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, when we say myofascial and trigger points in that sort of pain, you know, a couple of things I'd like to talk about is one, what is that we're talking about? And then two, I'd like to kind of then delve into what that looks like in practice, because I think that's a huge, huge area that's missed by many practitioners and many owners. And so maybe tell me a little bit how your interest in maybe an explanation for, you know, dog owners of what myofascial pain is, what trigger points are and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I think going back a little bit in history will kind of help answer that question. 2002, 2003, when I became interested in rehabilitation and went to University of Tennessee, became certified. 2004, opened up a rehab center with the treadmill and all the toys and started getting, you know, involved in rehab and learning as I went, just like we all did. Taking a little bit of knowledge we gained in a two-week course and what we could study on our own. And as I mentioned previously, I got involved in pain management because these animals were hurting. They were coming to orthopedic surgery or back surgery. Their pain wasn't adequately controlled. And the whole pain management, Joe, you know this, I mean, the whole pain management thing really began to mushroom in the early 2000s in veterinary medicine. And so I met a group of people that kind of were starting out in pain management, like Bob Stein in New York and Robin Downing and Mark Epstein. And then there was a group of us that were involved with rehab. And then everybody was crossing over. The people in pain management were interested in rehab and the rehab people were interested in pain management. So it really made for a great educating time. Back in those, I'm going to call it early days of this field that we now deal with. But I quickly also learned that our standard way of looking at orthopedic and spinal patients did not bring into account the muscles. We knew we would identify muscle atrophy when they would have a prolonged disuse in a limb. And we would talk about building that muscle strength back up with the different modalities we employed in rehab and different exercises. But what we didn't talk about was muscle pain. And when I would examine these dogs that would come to me, especially the real complicated cases that maybe they'd been non-weight bearing for a period of time, I would find that oftentimes I could find areas in their muscles that were much more painful than even the area where the surgery had been performed. So, you know, a dog might have a TPLO surgery for cruciate disease, and for one reason or another, they have a prolonged period of non-weight bearing. And when they come to us for help, I would examine them, and the joint that was operated on wasn't that painful, but yet the muscles that make that joint work were exquisitely painful. So I took that and I started reading and studying human literature because there's absolutely nothing in veterinary medicine about that. And so I started looking into that and I found this whole deal about trigger points and my pain. And so I started as I read and gained knowledge, I started examining patients differently, and I would examine them more specifically areas in the muscle. And one of the therapies that was beginning to gain some popularity was called dry needling. And so I started taking acupuncture needles, and this was actually before I even went and took acupuncture, but I started taking acupuncture needles, and I would just find painful areas and muscles, and I would just put needles in them. And if I got a reaction, which is called a local twitch response, that would validate that that was a trigger point. And back then, my palpation skills were horrible, and I was just like, you know, a blind person sticking needles in, but I also saw improvement in these patients. So I began to look at what can I do to increase my level of knowledge. And I found a group, the only thing that was going in human healthcare at the time, there's nothing in veterinary medicine, was two people in Bethesda, Maryland, that were putting on a 6-part seminar for physical therapists and physicians. And at the time, it was called the Janet Travell Seminar Series. Janet Travell is kind of considered the mother of myofascial pain and trigger points in people. It's fascinating history, fascinating lady. She's long since passed away, but she was the real person. And you can't read literature today, and there's tons of it now, but you can't read literature about myofascial pain and dysfunction without crossing Janet Travell's name somewhere in that literature. She lectured up until she was 95 years of age. Well, the two people that I met offering seminars in Bethesda were Jan Dommerholt, who is a doctor of physical therapy, and Dr. Robert Gerwin, who is a physician neurologist. But both of their practices were pretty much limited to myofascial pain. Both of them had known, and Dr. Gerwin especially, had worked with Dr. Travell. So I called them up and asked them if I could take their courses as a veterinarian. And they warmly embraced me. So between 2007 and 2009, it took me 2 years to complete the 6-part seminar series of, can't remember how, several hundred hours. Had to relearn, I had to learn a lot of human anatomy, all the muscles. It was a certification course that ended with a written exam and also a practical exam where I had to identify and needle certain muscles. And so I was fortunate in 2 years that I became the first veterinarian to ever complete their certification course and met a lot of good people on the way. And Jan Dommerholt and I, actually now Jan, to tell you where this is going in human healthcare, Jan Dommerholt, Dr. Gerwin is retired. Jan Dommerholt now owns, this has evolved into what's called Myo Pain Seminars with over 40 instructors that teach worldwide and all that. And so that certification course really opened my eyes to myofascial pain and dysfunction and all that. But even back then, Joe, I looked at this as just pain. You know, I thought my patients were painful. I could treat them. I could make them better. Doing all the other things we do too, mm-hmm. but I can make them better. But yet it was all from a pain. The reason why they were getting better is because they were less painful. And from that 2009 until today, it's really evolved in more to, I'm thinking about not only treating pain in these patients, but I'm treating dysfunction by treating their muscles. So if you have, or I say, if you have a problem in a joint, and the biggest joint problem we see in dogs is cruciate problems. If that dog has a cruciate problem, and they have joint dysfunction from the cruciate problem, they're going to have some degree of muscle dysfunction. And the longer they have joint dysfunction, the more muscle dysfunction they're going to have. When they have a TPLO done, and if you take the field trial dog that goes in and has a TPLO, the TPLO fixes or should fix the joint dysfunction over the next 6 months. But the TPLO does nothing for the muscle dysfunction. And the muscle dysfunction is due to myofascial pain. And myofascial pain is due to the presence of myofascial trigger points in the muscles. And a term we don't use in veterinary medicine that I use every day is called functional unit muscles. And what does that mean? The functional unit muscles are the muscles that activate a joint. So you generally, you know, you have flexors and you have extensors and you have abductors and you have abductors. So in the case of the stifle, the dog has a TPLO. Over time, the joint dysfunction improves. And some of those patients, the muscle dysfunction improves. Some of them, that's the ones that we help. And we improve. So when you have a trigger point in a muscle, it can be producing pain spontaneously, which means it's hurting all the time. Or maybe it only produces pain when we activate it or feel of it and put pressure on it. You've ever had a deep tissue massage and that massage therapist hits that really sore spot? That's probably a trigger point. Well, in people, they describe active as spontaneously producing and inactive as only produced when you apply pressure or irritate it. But all the other characteristics of trigger points, it doesn't matter whether it's active or inactive. And so it doesn't matter in our patients whether it's active or inactive. We're going to treat the trigger points that we find in the muscles, those functional unit muscles. And why is that important? Well, one of the big things that if you have trigger points in the muscle, they're inhibiting the strength within that muscle. And you cannot effectively rehabilitate a patient back to normal if you have a lot of trigger points in the muscles, because there's an inhibition there that can be helped almost immediately in some patients by treatment. So it's a restoration of function, which fits in with the restoration of strength and fitness and muscle size and all those other things that we incorporate into our rehabilitation program.
And I think
so. I find go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I find it interesting because I enjoy teaching, and we have a seminar series that we put on. We missed a few years, but we're going to kick back up hopefully this summer if things get straightened out. But I enjoy teaching people. I enjoy watching them when you show them, you know, here's this dog's not using its leg really well, and they're examining the joint and they're lasering the joint. And then I put my hand up on their thigh muscles and the dog turns around and wants to bite you. And they go, what is that?
Right,
you know,
right.
Yeah. I don't understand that.
And I think it's important, you know, a couple of points that you made that I'd like to reiterate, because I do think they're so important. In one is that when we go through vet school, it's changing now, but even I would say majority of the vet schools, this is training that's not received or has not been received by the vast majority of veterinarians in identifying these types of problems in these dogs. And so, you know, and we both see it daily in our practices, but those dogs that have had, say, a cruciate surgery that come in that has been deemed a failure by the owner, maybe a failure by the managing veterinarian, and the surgeon says, well, the joint is fine. It's not a failure. It's that disconnect in that everybody's right in a sense, right? The surgeon's part did go well, and the other people managing the case maybe don't have the knowledge to say, hey, it's actually a muscle problem up in the hip flexors that's causing these dogs excruciating pain. And so, yes, the joint is fixed. And I just think it's worth reiterating that there's a lot of these dogs that don't return to normal function due to no fault of the surgery failing, but that the dog wasn't completely addressed as far as its problems when it comes to these soft tissues and the muscles and things like that, because we're not given that training as part of our training in vet school.
No, the when we learned our anatomy your first year in vet school, you know, and they still are taught out of the same anatomy book, just a different version that we were all taught out of. And it doesn't mention functional unit muscles one time. It places muscles on anatomical locations. So it talks about the cranial thigh, the inner thigh. And that never made one bit of sense to me whatsoever, period.
No.
And so, and our orthopedics, the only reason we would ever look between a joint on orthopedics was if a bone was broken, but we didn't look at muscle. And I think now people are getting a little better at doing it, but it's still, we've trained a lot of people or had a lot of people come to the seminar. Some people go home and embrace it, some don't.
Right.
That's like anything else, but it's at least it works for me, and I have found that it's like anything else we do in practice. You continue to improve, you continue to learn, you more and more literature's coming out, and we begin to understand things. And I think one thing too is our training in veterinary school, and even after veterinary school, and especially surgeons and neurosurgeons and that, as well as our human healthcare counterparts, we're taught to find a structural lesion, especially the surgeon. If you can find a structural lesion that you can blame for the problem, can do surgery and fix it. And the surgeons, if they can find that structural lesion, well, that's the problem. Let's go take care of that and we'll fix that. And sometimes that does. Oftentimes that works, thank goodness. And then sometimes take better in spite of what. But the thing about muscle pain and myofascial pain dysfunction, it really isn't a structural lesion that we're going to identify with our typical imaging equipment.
Right.
Yes, there's ultrasounds that can identify trigger points, but they run about $250,000, and there's no clinical reason to do that. But with all imaging, we were having a conversation before we started. We have CT scans in our clinic now. I mean, we didn't even have. There wasn't such thing as a CT scan in veterinary medicine when I graduated from veterinary school, much less than now. Now we have CTs in our clinic along
Right.
with radiographs, and we're all, most of the people in rehab do some level of musculoskeletal ultrasound. And why do we have all this stuff? Because we're looking for structural lesions that are causing the problem. Well, that. If that's all you're going to do, you're going to help a lot of patients. But if you don't use your hands at where the pain is, and which is what you have to do with muscle, then you're not going to solve every, you're not going to find every source of pain and dysfunction or explain why this patient's not doing the way that it should. And why are we not seeing anything on MRI? Why are we not seeing anything on CT scan? Why are we not seeing anything on X-rays? And the surgery, the bone's healed already on the TPL. The dog's just not doing the way that it should. And those are the kinds of patients I think we're having an understanding of myofascial pain and dysfunction and trigger points and treating them, and what they do and their character, all that. Those are the patients that you can make a difference on. And if you have an understanding, you'll make a difference on patients that others. And that's where it's helped me in my practice. And
Right.
it's just fascinating to
No,
me.
I
That's
agree.
my,
I
it's just
think,
fascinating.
so most of the listeners are going to be people, with athletic dogs. So talking TPLO and TPLO dysfunction is obviously right in their wheelhouse. The other place that I'd like to maybe touch on this a little bit, that I think is a huge part of my practice is geriatrics and both geriatric performance dogs, but just geriatric house dogs that, are poor doers, right? They're dogs that, start getting real thin in the muscle, a lot of muscle wasting in the back end. They have difficulty rising. They've been diagnosed without any sort of imaging as being dogs that have hip dysplasia or back issues, and they've had a lot of drugs thrown at them, and nothing seems to work. And of course, they come to see people like you and I after this has been going on for multiple years. But can you talk to those dogs? Because I feel like a vast majority of those dogs are muscle dysfunction dogs, and very much like with older people where we have the electric chairs to be able to get people up and down from seated positions, that as we age, we have, you know, the fine motor control starts being lost. And if we don't jump on board with functional training, but then also addressing this myofascial pain, can you give us your opinion on that geriatric dog that, you know, was maybe misdiagnosed as being an arthritic dog, but it's actually this functional problem? Do you see a lot of those dogs in your practice?
Well, I think oftentimes in that geriatric patient, you have both. You know, I mean, they may have some degree of arthritis or whatever.
Right.
And maybe that arthritis is the joint dysfunction that's causing the muscle dysfunction. And you can help those patients by treating the muscle dysfunction, but it's going to keep coming back. Why? Because you're not getting rid of the perpetuating factor, which is the arthritic patient. But we do know as patients get older, especially in the athletes, you're going to lose muscle size due to normal aging changes. We call that sarcopenia. Exercise, good diet and good nutrition and routine exercise will help maintain muscle in that older geriatric patient, and especially that athlete or that hunting dog or whatever their working dog, whatever they do, keeping them active, keeping them skinny, keeping on a high level of nutrition so that they're getting adequate protein. All those things help to slow down sarcopenia, the muscle getting smaller with age, but it's still going to happen. It is still going to happen. And I don't care, as dogs get older, if the muscle's getting smaller, they're going to lose strength. I am not as strong as I was when I was a teenager. It's just normal. It's going to happen.
Right.
Now, if you add to that a joint problem like arthritis, it creates muscle dysfunction. So not only now do you have a decline in strength due to muscle size getting smaller with age, now you add in muscle dysfunction, which causes an inhibition of the muscle. It can really begin to affect performance in those athletes. So when we're working with an arthritic dog or an old geriatric patient that's having a pain situation, some of those dogs fit the term chronic widespread pain just mm-hmm. because they have so much muscle involvement. And you can help those dogs by treating them, sometimes dramatically. But there again, keep in mind, why is that occurring? It's because you have dysfunctional joints. We can't make that go away. Maybe we can replace the hip with a total hip, that would make that dysfunction go away. Maybe we can use joint therapies, joint injections, and medicine, the joint function, you're going to have the muscle function. So, you know, I had an orthopedic surgeon when I was going to school. They always said something that I never forget. And his comment was, to every fracture is attached a patient. And what he meant by that, and why it was so profound, is, you know, you got to do more than just fix the fracture. You got to fix the patient. And so I think when you look at an arthritic patient, if all you do is put them on an NSAID, then you're not helping the other parts of that arthritic patient. You're not, you know, if you don't look at their nutrition status and you don't look at their exercise status, if you don't get weight off of them, if you don't do something to maybe treat the muscle dysfunction, of course, Joe, I talked about needling, but, you know, there's some evidence that low-level laser therapy will, we use low-level laser therapy, my technicians do, mm-hmm. to treat myofascial pain. They can find it, manual therapies and all that. So it's not just having to learn how to put a needle in a trigger point. So that's just one part of that multimodal treatment regimen that we would employ in older pet. And I think another fascinating area that has evolved, especially I think over the past 7 or 8 years, that kind of fell into was looking at athletes, some of which maybe had injuries and we helped in the rehabilitation process. But I have a fair number of athletes now that come to me prior to competitions or things like, you know, agility people is in tune with their any group of people I know. You know, they're doing the training of the dogs. It's their hobby. It's their love. The dogs are part of their family. They live with them every day. They travel with them. They're just really in tune. And we have several of those dogs that will come in and we'll treat them on a routine basis, oftentimes before competitions. Why do we keep doing it? Because they're so in tune with the dogs, they recognize the difference. So we're improving muscle function. And in that athlete, that's even more critical. If you could imagine, if you had a pro baseball pitcher that had Tommy John surgery, and Tommy John fixed the structural lesion that was present in the elbow. But if you don't work on the muscles in the shoulder of that and get the function of all those muscles to a pro baseball pitcher, a little bit of dysfunction could mean a career if they can't reach the same thing. I actually knew someone, and I think that was exactly their problem. So, you know, yes, I think you can help geriatric patients. I think you can help the hunting dogs, the old field trial dogs, you know, the test dogs, all those dogs might benefit. I don't have as many hunting type field test dogs that come to us on a proactive type situation as we do agility people, right, and obedience people.
And I think some of it maybe is a lack of knowledge of the effectiveness and availability in that. I my hope is it will come. I feel like sometimes, and even within the hunting dog world, I think that you have the different segments that lag behind, you know, others. You know, you have the spaniel and retriever people, you know, the pointing dog people, the versatile dogs, the hounds. You know, there's some stratification there, and I think even within like the field trial, retriever world, you know, I think you have people that are willing to travel across the country for dogs where there's still people that look at those dogs. I don't want to say as tools, but there are those owners that don't view them as this, you know, working athlete. And I think your point, you know, with the baseball player, you know, you watch any of these pro sports, and they have athletic trainers, they have, you know, team physicians, and, you know, they're constantly needing managed. And I think for so long with these canine athletes, we've just thought that they were, you know, Superman, right? They could just go and always do this stuff without any intervention from us, versus, you know, doing some of the things that we do to, you know, make good dogs even better, you know, is how I try to promote it. And, you know, it's not necessarily a sign of weakness or that there's a problem with that dog. It's if you use that body hard, there's going to be aches and pains that sometimes need to be addressed.
I find a lot of athletes that I evaluate, and, you know, I'm probably like you. I probably have as much interest in the sports medicine aspect of things now as I do anything else. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's just evolved. You know, that's nothing we would even thought about. And there's so many different athletic endeavors dogs can get involved in. You know, you and I are more of the hunting dog type people, but I see a lot of agilities and obedience, and, you know, there's all kinds of fly ball. There's all kinds of things. But one common characteristic, and you and I've talked about this, that I see in a lot of athletes are weak core strength. And I think the agility people, they have a lot of avenues out there with companies like Fit Paws USA and some of the things they, Sasha Foster has written a little book on, you know, cross training the canine athlete, which is basically talking about core strengthening. Sasha, she needs to give me a royalty on every book because I talk about her book all the time. But I find weak core. Well, what is the core in a dog? And it's muscle, right? And I define the core muscles in a dog as the dorsal paraspinal muscles that begin up in the cervical region, the neck region, and go all the way down over the chest cavity, and then over the back, and then the ventral paraspinals, which are in the lumbar region, the iliopsoas, or the psoas major gets all the publicity, and the iliopsoas complex, all the publicity now. And I also put the gluteal or the hip muscles in that. Well, what does that do? That's the foundation to the pelvic limbs in a dog. And where do we see a lot of orthopedic problems in dogs? We see it in the pelvic limbs. If you have a weak core strength in the pet dog, it is not as big a deal as if you have weak core strength in the athlete. And especially if that athlete's been injured for a period of time, are gone through knee surgery, their core body is really going to be weak. And so I part of the canine athlete, part of that weakness is also due to the presence of trigger points in those muscles. So you have to treat the trigger points, but you also have to put them on core strengthening exercises. In the animal that's recovering from injury, a lot of the weakness is due to trigger points, because of that joint dysfunction, muscle dysfunction type thing. And that's how you understand things. And that's where we get into helping that canine athlete return to a high level of performance, or maybe even give them a little bit better performance. Most of the pro tennis players get routine dry needling for trigger points prior to competitions now. The men will get needled, and I've talked to some of the physical therapists to do that. The men tennis players will get trigger point dry needling. They'll do it right up to the time they walk out on the court. Women like to have it a few days before. There's a number of pro football teams now that are needling the athletes. Why? Because the athletes detect improvements in strength, joint range of, range of motion, those muscles, decrease in soreness and all that. And it started with the Washington Redskins a number of years ago, needling their athletes. So that we get feedback from the human athletes, and there's studies on the human athletic side that talk about, this term from our physical therapy colleagues that work with us in rehabilitation in dogs. They talk about motor control and timing. And I always say, well, what does that mean? And when I ask a physical, I love for a physical therapist to say that, because I like to, I like to poke them a little bit. So what does that mean? What is motor control? Well, that's your muscle controlling this. I don't either. It's probably my lack of knowledge, but I never understand what they're talking about. Okay. But what I talk about, and I don't know what causes that, physical therapist training tends to relate everything to the joint. So if they think they have a muscle problem, they've got to work on the joint and do their joint nobs and all that to fix that motor control and timing. Well, what we do know, if you have trigger points, this is what I understand. What we do know if you have trigger points is it alters the normal muscle firing patterns within a muscle, and it inhibits the strength of that muscle. So if there is a recruitment pattern for a functional group of muscles to move the shoulder joint, and you have trigger points in there, those muscles are not recruited in the same sequence or in the same time frame that they would be if you don't have those trigger points. And there's studies to validate that. That makes sense to me. I understand that. Okay. And I also know that you have inhibition of the muscle because of the trigger point. So that's that's the motor control and timing that are physical. I think we're talking about exactly the same thing.
Right.
I'm just looking at it from a muscle perspective. Dr. Dahmerholt, when we teach the canine course, will do a demonstration. And there's always somebody in the course. And keep in mind, when he's teaching this to human healthcare providers, you are examining and needling each other, and it's fabulous feedback. For three of my six courses, I had the same partner who was a physical therapist in Alabama, and we still, after all these years, communicate several times a year. And we were partners, and I would examine him, and I say, is that what I'm feeling? He goes, yeah, that's it. And I would put a needle, and, you know, I mean, we needled each other, and we did all that. That's how I learned. That's the feedback. And we incorporate a little bit of that into our canine course. But Jan does a demonstration that the first time I saw it, it blew me out of the water, and it completely changed the way I look at trigger points. He has somebody in the class with low back pain, and there's always, out of 20 people, there's always somebody has low back pain because it's so prevalent. And he'll have them lay on the table on their side, and he'll have them abduct their leg. And he'll put his hand over their ankle. They're laying on their side, and they're kind of, they've abducted their upper limb. And he'll say, okay, I'm going to push down, and I want you to resist as much as possible. And he'll say, one, two, three, and he'll push them, and they have no resistance at all in collapsing that leg. They have no strength to maintain that abduction. He'll do, and I haven't been able to accomplish a demo like this in dogs. He'll examine their quadratus lumborum, which is a big muscle on the side of our backs, and it's very much involved in low back pain in people. And he'll find, every time he's ever done this, he'll find an exquisitely painful trigger point in that quadratus lumborum, which has nothing to do with abduction or adduction of the hip joint. There's no connection there. Mm-hmm. But he'll find it, and you'll see these people grimace when he finds it. Of course, this is what he does for a living.
Right.
He'll needle that one trigger point, or he'll manually release that by applying pressure, and there's all kinds of manual techniques. But he'll treat that one trigger point, and he'll repeat that same test. And they can resist his pressure to sometimes I have seen even in females that he's done the demo on, that he's now putting both hands and leaning body weight over trying to push the leg down. One trigger point.
It's crazy.
When I saw that demo the first time, it completely changed the way. If our patients have that, and they do,
right?
How is that athlete ever going to return to 100% soundness?
Right.
You know, will that trigger point work itself out at some point in the future by itself without any treatment? Yeah, some do. I don't know. But look how much quicker we can get them.
Right.
That's what really opened my eyes to dysfunction. It was first time he did that demo, my jaw dropped.
Yeah.
I never saw him do a demonstration like that when I went through all the human courses between 2007 and 2009. He did that as part of the canine course. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. No, it is. I actually just went through some gluteal piriformis issues of my own that, you know, I thought was going to be lower back, and it wasn't. It was, you know, the muscles below, and it was the same sort of thing, horrible dysfunction, and went to the doctor to get a PT script, and they just wanted to put me on steroids thinking it was a disc. And, you know, within, you know, 10 minutes of manual therapy and then literally two stretches at 30 seconds in two reps, so 2 minutes of stretching, I was 1,000% better in the hands of that physical therapist. And the MD wanted to put me on 2 weeks of drugs that likely would have done nothing because it wasn't a disc. You know, I had those signs, but when the PT did her evaluation, you know, she cleared my discs as a problem. She identified where it was, released the trigger points, and had me do some exercises. And I mean, it was like a miracle. And so I guess let's maybe bring that full circle then here as you know, we start kind of coming towards the end. We talk a lot about this technical stuff in these trigger points. What do you recommend, you know, for that owner that, you know, has seen their regular veterinarian or has had surgery and not been the hands of a rehab professional? What are some of the things you recommend that they may be seeing in their dogs that may be indicative of this type of dysfunction, whether it's the geriatric or the post-surgery dog? And then, you know, what do you recommend to people to be able to get their dogs in the hands of people like you You know, if they don't live in Texas or they don't live in South Dakota, you know, what do you recommend for that? So let's first talk about the dogs. What are people going to see, you know, with a dog that maybe isn't just having complications post-surgery or a geriatric with just arthritis? What are some of the things that indicate muscle dysfunction when an owner gives you history?
There again, it really depends on the given patient. And that geriatric dog, if it has arthritis, there's going to be some degree of muscle dysfunction. And, you know, there are different canine massage courses and things that people can take. And I think there's some benefit learning that and examining muscles and seeing if the dog says, ouch, when you touch a certain area. That might be a key to say, you know, is muscle a component in this problem? We treat muscles in every postoperative patient, be it, I don't always need a postoperative patient because I have a technician that's so efficient in manual therapies and laser therapy that I don't have to needle as much probably as I did a long time ago. So that orthopedic patient, if it's a stifle, I can tell you the muscles are going to be a problem. There may be other muscles too, but I can tell you the muscles are going to be a problem. You have a dog with bad hips, and they've been chronically bad for a long time. I can tell you that they're going to be painful in their triceps muscles on the front end. They're going to be painful in their latissimus dorsi, teres major in the front. And I know those are big words for people that don't study muscles, but you know why? Those muscles are being asked to compensate for that shifting of weight forward in that dog. So, I mean, are you going to make the hip problem go away if you treat those muscles? Nope, you're not. But what you're going to do is you're going to help those muscles. They're going to become stronger, less painful. So now the dog can move better and the function better. The athlete that's recovering from surgery, we're going to treat muscles. Athlete, there again, I wish I would have the opportunity to do more of this. I wish we had the opportunity in my practice to examine athletes when they weren't hurt and do core body exams on those dogs and muscle exams, because you find problems. And, people don't tend to come in unless their dog has a problem, right?
Right.
And so I wish we could be more proactive in that. And then what do? Well, we teach them how to do massages, or they go take a canine massage course. There is a lot more understanding about trigger points than there used to be 15, 16 years ago. And you can't even imagine in the 40s when Dr. Travell started dealing with it in human healthcare, the thing she came up. Travell was John F. Kennedy's personal physician. She became White House physician for John F. Kennedy. And she had a lot to do with getting him through the campaign and his presidency, because he had really bad back problems. And he was also an Addison's patient. But he had really bad back problems, and she treated his back problems with trigger point therapy. She did needling, but she did injections. And one of the books I have on her has a picture of him with a signed copy.
Oh, really?
Basically saying he didn't think he could have become president without that help with the back pain. You know, he had the rock, see pictures of him in the rocker, because that was more comfortable on his back than it was going to say chronic low back pain. Joe, it gets down to anything else. We have to examine patients in their entirety,
right?
Knowing what they do, what they're not doing, what decline in functional abilities they have at home. And I really do think that as people involved with sports medicine, rehab, and pain management, we probably have developed the skills to do that just about as well as anybody.
Along those lines, so for people, you know, in other parts of the country, in your opinion, what are some of the certifications that you'd recommend they'd look for in a veterinarian that at least would potentially indicate that they may, you know, think this way when they're looking at patients? Do you, you know, are there certifications in your mind that carry a little bit more weight than others, I guess?
Well, needless to say, if you're looking for somebody to help in rehab, you like somebody with a certification in rehab. And I think all the rehab courses are teaching a lot more about muscle now than they did back when I took them. You know, there's a lot more focus on muscle now and problems related to muscle. And all of the, I think we have three rehab certification courses. I think those are good. There's a number of people out there do chiropractic. I'd love to go do chiropractic if I could ever find time. They're getting some of the things that chiropractors do. They're looking at joints. They're finding little abnormalities in the joints. They're doing rapid adjustments or little mobilizations, and especially mainly along the spine in dogs. And what are they doing? Sometimes they're also rapidly stretching those muscles, which can relieve trigger points. I think sometimes, I may get some criticism, but I think one of the reasons that sometimes going back and back and back and back to chiropractors is because they don't deal with the muscle component of the problem, right? Because they're both functioning there. Some of the physical therapists around the country that deal with animals have a good understanding of the athletes and canine. There's some that are exceptional, and just like people in our profession, not everybody's equal. Some people excel in skills, and it's the same with physical therapists. Some people don't. So, but I think people with some kind of rehab background, sports medicine background, movement, involvement, watching dogs move and feel. There's a new book that just came out that Felix Duer, the surgeon, one of our colleagues in sports medicine rehab, but he's also a qualified surgeon at Colorado State. Felix asked me to write a chapter in the book, and I just got my copy. It's called Canine Lameness, and I'm looking forward to looking through this. There are people like Felix at Colorado State that have really, as a surgeon, really, he works closely with Sasha Foster, and he's really tried to bring in things other than orthopedic surgery. This is where this door is opening, and we're talking between specialties. So it's hard to tell. It's hard to answer your question. What specifically do you look for? I think I know how people find you in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It's because of the reputation you have, and they talk, and it's a lot of word of mouth. And I have a lot of people, you know, people don't get in the car and drive for somebody that's doing rehab. It's usually a word of mouth thing, and it's the relationships that you've built with specialists in the region. And so I think people need to question their primary veterinarians, their surgeons, their specialists who did work. Is there someone in the area that might help my dog? And word of mouth, you know, I see a lot of people because of word of mouth.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I don't want to say I set you up with that. I don't have a good answer for it is why I asked. It's the same thing. I think reputation is big in reputation of maybe what you're looking for outcomes. And so, you know, I get that question a lot, you know, somebody from, you know, I don't know, middle Ohio, and they'll say, how do I find somebody? And if I don't personally know someone, it's difficult because, like you say, that you can have people with board certifications that, you know, there's varying degree of abilities in thought processes and things like that. And that's where, you know, I had an individual that was in the Houston area that, you know, we thought needed surgery. And what did I do? Reached out to you and said, hey, where are we going to get that dog get to you for rehab? And so I think it is having those connections and people you trust, their opinions to make recommendations. So,
yeah. And I think that's what it boils down to is talking to people. Some, you know, I've had some people come through my course that really left the course and embraced it. Adding it to as another tool in their toolbox to do things, and a number of those people I keep in touch with, so I can, you know, if somebody in Ontario, Canada, I can send them to Jan Huntingford. You know, I mean, it's like those are the kind of relationships, and our community of sports medicine and rehab and pain management is really kind of small. So a lot of us know people all over the country, you know, and across paths with people all over the country. So I think if you talk to someone in the field, if they've been in it for a while, they can sure give good recommendations to other people.
Sure.
It's word of mouth, either professional word of mouth through veterinarians or through clients that have had their patients to someone.
So I pulled up Amazon and for those, so the Canine Lameness book is out on Amazon. So that would be one way. And again, it's a veterinary textbook basically. So it's geared towards veterinarians, but I think it would probably be an interesting read for people very interested in performance dogs. You have a chapter there. If people wanted to get in touch with you, what's the best way? Is it social media, your website for the clinic? You know, if you have people.
Yeah, my probably email.
Okay.
Dr. Wall, like Dr. Wall, W-A-L-L at wall.com, W-A-L-L-V as in Victor E.com.
Okay. And I'll put that in the show notes. And then I'll also put a link to the web, to your practice, the animalclinicsofthewoodlands.com website, so that people can look you up. And I think, you know, we didn't probably fully brag on you enough in the intro. You're also very active in the legislative portion of our profession and recently served as the president of the Texas Veterinary Medical Association. I assume we'll continue to have, you know, activities there as the immediate past president as well?
I am considered immediate past president now, and yes, absolutely. I love the legislative process on the state level, and so I fully expect that I will continue to be involved with that, and you know, we just have a lot of fun doing that. So a lot of issues in veterinary medicine. Somebody has to stay on top of it.
Yep.
And because things can slip up on you.
No, absolutely. I serve on the veterinary examining board out here. I do. I think it's very important to have people that are in the trenches also, you know, active in those roles. And so I give you incredible kudos for leading that charge in Texas. And then we'll end on what I feel is a good note. Tell us a little bit about your hunting background with your dog and predominantly what you chase down that way.
I wish I had a bigger hunting background. you know, I'm like most Texas people. You grow up hunting and fishing from the time I remember. I have memories of being in a boat with my dad 3 years old. You know, I can just remember, I remember about five jumping out one night and a moccasin hit the stringer of fish instead of my leg. And hunting, and I'm from East Texas, and so hunting in the river bottoms in East Texas, I kind of got out, you know, all through vet school and early career, I didn't get to hunt and fish as much as I wanted to. I got into offshore fishing 15 years ago and, you know, was fortunate enough to have my own boat and, you know, do 100-mile offshore trips. And I've caught all the big offshore fish. And now I'm too old. It takes me too long to recover from that now. So I had become really interested in duck hunting. And it's very much a learning experience for me right now of all kinds of bird hunting. I've got more guns than I know what to do with. I've got my first true hunting dog. I have a soon-to-be dog that would have probably finished his master hunt test had he not developed some shoulder problems. So I took him out of training, and he hunts, and he's my best friend and hangs out with me all the time. And I don't know that there's a better experience than and I've had some good ones. I've caught a 450-pound marlin in my boat, on my gear, on a rig that I lured, nobody else touched the line. And, you know, experiences, I'm not so sure that compares to watching that duck or watching that dog go get that first start. And so that's what I kind of enjoy right now. And we have some pretty good waterfowl hunting west of Houston, Texas. Pretty, all up and down the coast of Texas is a pretty good flyway. Pretty good season this year. Not great, but pretty good. Caleb, my dog, is a heck of a lot better hunter than I am. He loves to go find. The hardest thing I have is teaching him that he's hunting for me and not hunting for himself, because he knows they're over there. So I have to, opening season, we had our limit, and then he found another one and brought it back. So we kind of had to hide that one, and you know how that goes. I don't get to do the deer hunting and things that I used to. Deer hunting in Texas is a huge business with a lot of different political factions now. And it's changed the kind of hunting I grew up with. But I hopefully, as my practice career begins to wind down and slow down a little bit in a few years, maybe I'll get to do more.
Yeah. No, we've talked about it for too long. I think you and Caleb need to try to get up here this fall, and I'd love to come down there next fall or winter and make that happen. So,
yeah, he would love it.
Yeah, no, I have no
he
doubt.
He would love it.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much for taking the time out of your day and greatly appreciate you imparting your knowledge upon us.
Enjoyed it, my friend.
All right. Take care. Thanks for listening to this episode of Fueled. If you like what you hear, we would appreciate you leaving us a review wherever you get your podcast. To stay up to date on this show and so much more in the sporting dog world, check out my website, gundogdoc.com, or follow me on Instagram at gundogdoc. Be sure to check out our sponsors page at yukonubasportingdog.com and on Instagram at yukonubasportingdog. If there's a topic you'd like us to tackle, don't hesitate to reach out and let us know. This show is for you, our listeners, as we work to fuel your knowledge on sporting dog health. Thanks for listening.